to three people who have been invited to stand at the lunch table and make remarks. And it seems pretty clear to me that that's not necessarily the intention of making remarks. I had a conversation with the speaker today, and we brainstormed a little bit about what a guideline might look like around making remarks or serving on a panel. And one point we got to in the conversation was, is there a number of people that are present before you're making remarks or serving on a panel? What might that number be? Is it distinguished by it's an event that requires an agenda? We also realized that we've already taken care of many of these situations because we did the exemption for public officials. And for several members, initially they were concerned about being able to go to the breakfasts or coffees that their county commissions or school boards held and being able to make remarks. That's no longer an issue since we exempted elected officials. So with that, I'd like to have us start with this issue of making remarks. I think we can move on to serving on a panel next. I think that's a little easier to get our arms around, and I would entertain, well, Ramona, do you have any further input before we begin this discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, for the record, my name is Ramona Kennedy. I'm Chief Clerk and Parliamentarian, and good evening. Actually, I have not had many inquiries about this provision under the gift guidelines. I think that the intent of the rule was made pretty clear at the beginning of the session, and although there has been some situations that were presented early on as to, does that mean if I go to dinner with some individuals and they ask me to make remarks at the end of the dinner, does that basically fit within the guidelines? My recommendation was that they need to be very cautious in how they are viewing this, that clearly the intent was that it would be something that would be a little bit more official than an evening where there might be a dinner and remarks would be made maybe to a small group. However, I look for your guidance. I have not had inquiries about this over the last month, so I don't know if maybe the dust has settled and individuals have kind of figured that out. My biggest concern, however, Madam Chair, will be as we move into the interim process, as these rules potentially could stay on the books, not knowing what, you know, the will of the House might be. And so right now there's not that many opportunities for members to serve on panels and or in making remarks, but as we move into the interim process, I think that will be a lot more the case. And so I think this guidance would be very critical at that point in time.
Thank you. Representative Bernhardt, Representative Richardson, would either of you like to start the ball rolling?
I'm willing.
Great. Representative Richardson.
I think the idea of speaking before a panel or making remarks are very closely aligned, and that if we solve one, we can solve the other. And I would think that to avoid the situation where it's really just a small group of people and they say, we want you to come and make remarks and we fit in this exemption, that we might consider having it be before a regularly organized body or group at a regularly scheduled meeting. And that way, if it's the Capital Club, that's one thing. If it's three lobbyists, it doesn't count. If it's a Rotary Club, if it's, of course, they may not have items before the legislature, but say some trade group. If it's a trade association, then it's a regularly organized group. And if it's at one of their monthly meetings, it's a regularly scheduled meeting. And so by having wording that would do that, we're saying that whether you're speaking individually, making remarks, or you're part of a panel, it really doesn't matter as long as it's to a regularly scheduled meeting of an organized group, legally organized group or something like that.
Would that include, Representative Richardson, if you had a group or groups coming together? So healthcare, we're all talking about healthcare. In my community, there's an interfaith group, there's a Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates, and they come together to sponsor breakfasts or lunches or panels, and they bring speakers in. Would that be covered in that group, even though it wasn't the regularly scheduled meeting of any of those individual groups. It was a formal meeting that was convened by a group of groups.
Madam Speaker, when I say regularly scheduled, I'm not meaning that it has to be like an annual meeting. It would just be an organization that is scheduling a meeting. And so, I mean, be scheduled in a regular manner, not just an ad hoc group of people that want to get together.
For lunch, at least.
Yeah, that's right. So, but if they had two or three groups that got together, one of them would be kind of making the invitation. They would say, you know, this is, we're a part of a regularly scheduled our group, and we're going to have this meeting. We would like you to address our group of invited.
Oh, you mean duly?
It could be doing duly, yeah.
Duly is what you mean, I think, rather than regularly. I suspect.
Duly scheduled.
Right.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Yeah, because regularly, I think, implies that it's that the normal time.
That's correct. So a duly scheduled is a better.
I think it's that's my sense of what you were.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so that would cover special events. If the Trade Association was having their annual conference, if Representative Barnhart was invited to address the annual gathering, the legislative gathering of the Oregon School Boards Association,
yes.
that would be covered.
Organization, and they have
duly organized
this meeting.
That's a reasonable limitation on it. I'm trying to think what other parameters you might want to have. I could imagine another parameter might be that in the call for the meeting there was an indication that so-and-so would be speaking, or that there would be a legislative panel, or that there would be a panel including legislators, or something like that that would indicate something about that. Although that I feel less concerned about that than I do about the other criteria that Representative Richardson has suggested.
What I just wrote was at a duly scheduled meeting of a legally established organization. And of course, just to try and get the idea of what we're discussing.
Might we consider just using established rather than legally established? I would think some of these advocacy groups might be informal ad hoc groups that truly are organized, but they might not have any legal documents that bind them together. For example, and if I were to go back to that healthcare example, an interfaith alliance of members of multiple congregations that get together, they might meet regularly, but they might not have a chartered organization. They might not have bylaws. They might not have articles of incorporation. It's just something informally that those groups have put together that's become a community type of an organization.
I understand that. The concern is getting back to ad hoc meetings at Joe's Bar for purposes of lobbying or advocating.
And I wouldn't want to go there. I do think that all of us have groups to whom it would be appropriate for us to go speak that aren't formalized, because they're not trade associations, they're not paid, they're not professional organizations. They are the local pro-choice or right-to-life organizations that are the advocacy groups. They're the local groups of college students.
So far, no. Okay, now that may be different. So far, everything you said was a group, was an organization that is regularly established. Now, if it's a group of college students, they probably wouldn't have items before the legislature, although it's possible. I don't know. It's just, you know, that's...
Well, regularly established, I don't have a problem with that. It's the legally established. If I were to think, for example, of in our local community, there's a local Planned Parenthood advocacy group. They meet, they have regularly scheduled meetings, they have a regular group of people that meet together that's 25 or 30 people, but they're not incorporated as an organization. They don't exchange money.
They're not money. A branch
they're not
Planned Parenthood.
You know, I don't know that. I don't know that for sure.
What you could do is you could say a legally organized, a legal organization, or a group which has regular meetings, and that would take care of both of those issues. A legally constituted organization is one that has a charter of some kind, even if it's self-issued. I mean, in Oregon, you don't have to have articles of incorporation or a some kind of a state-sanctioned charter to be an association. You can just declare yourself to be one. And the less informal ones, the only way you can actually tell they exist is that they have a name and they meet regularly.
Right.
They don't have bylaws. They don't have. They don't have necessarily even a regularly recognized structure. They may have a convener. I know of organizations that simply have a convener whose job it is to make sure that people know about the next meeting time, and that's it.
Have we got back to a group of six or eight lobbyists that just wanted to have a majority leader or the minority leader show up and give them lunch and they want some remarks?
Yeah.
But they do meet once a month and
right. See, you're giving us the other side of that same argument.
So it's finding that balance between those constituents of ours that are community-based people that maybe will get at that, although many of these people are going to have an interest before the legislature because they might be advocating a position on a bill, universal health care.
Okay. We could also say, not including lobbyists.
Does business before the legislature include advocating a position that doesn't lead to some kind of improvement of my position or my situation? I mean, we could say business before the legislature means people who are going to make something out of it for themselves, or we can say business before the legislature means you advocate a position on something.
That's kind of shifting down to another agenda.
Well, it is and it isn't, because the answer to that question may determine the answer to this one.
But Ramona has something to add.
Has something to add. Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, again, Ramona Kennedy. After just listening to your conversation and sort of where you've been coming from, I think we go back again, and we've gone back to this position at every single committee meeting, is that at some point in time, it has to be self-policing. I think it's pretty clear where the committee is sort of coming down and sort of where their definition is being sort of set is that it's a duly organized meeting, that it is a meeting of, you know, whether you use legal, established, but it's a meeting of groups and or organizations, either singularly or maybe together, where they would like to have a member come and speak to them, either making remarks or serving on a panel. You as the committee members can try to, you know, fine-tune this to a point to make it very, very clear, but I'm not sure at what point it goes beyond that piece. And I think, you know, again, I think Representative Barnhart is correct that when you finally get to the determination on who has business before the legislature, that will probably sift out. But I think that as far as the intent of the rule, I believed, was not to necessarily allow a member to go to dinner with five or six lobbyists and make remarks and get around the rule, but it really was to suggest that if you are invited to speak, whether it's in your district, whether it's at a statewide regularly scheduled annual meeting of an organization, that you should be able to do that if they are serving meals, that you should be able to accept that meal. And we've done the same when we've talked about committee meetings. We've done the same when we've actually set the limit at $10. So I would just suggest to the committee members and Madam Chair that you might want to think about putting in some language there of the intent of the rule and let the members then follow through with their self-policing.
And I think that makes sense in large part because this is an issue that's been raised by a couple of members who have observed this behavior. I don't know that I've heard anybody actually observe this behavior in other members. They've observed this in invitations. I don't know that members have taken up these kinds of offers to make remarks at a private lunch. But these clearly aren't questions that are coming to you, and that tells me that what we really need to be clear about is the intent, so that members can be clear as they're accepting and declining invitations what the spirit of the rule.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to suggest that even though you may have been seeing these invitations and members may be participating, I would also suggest they probably are paying for their own meal.
Mm-hmm.
they understand what the intent of the rule is. So to participate is okay. To take, you know, have somebody else pay for the meal is not. And I keep trying to suggest to members as they want to know, can they go to this reception? Can they go to this function? Can they go to, you know, this event? That they really, yes, absolutely, you can go. The question is, do you pick up the tab or can somebody else?
I guess the one other question that I would have, I'm satisfied with where we've come to on this point, and I think that maybe you and I can work together to pass back some language that might be a letter that we send to our colleagues at the conclusion of our work as a guidelines committee about the spirit of the guidelines and the work that we've done. Could be a format that we send that out in. But on the matter of serving on a panel, one of the questions that came up early as we were discussing these rules, and I don't know if anyone has come to you with the situation, I would imagine it would be more prevalent during the interim. I tend to think of a panel as something where there's a group of people that are sitting and there's an audience that's listening. Do you believe that there's enough clarity in the guidelines to allow members to participate in policy work group types of activities where they might be working on a subgroup of the Oregon Business Association or working on a policy group of the chalkboard project, where they are, as legislators, participating in furthering policy discussions that are going to be presented later or might become part of a conference later, but it's not formally a panel because there's not an audience. It's in that thought development process.
Madam Chair, members, again, I go back to the, and we will get to the definition of who's doing business before the legislature. I would suggest that if someone is working diligently in their capacity as a legislator in policy development with a group, that probably would rise above the gift guideline regulations, in that they are there for the purposes of trying to build a consensus on some legislation that may be pending. Again, I look at who has business before the legislature, and I guess the question that will come back ultimately to you, Madam Chair, and to you, members of the committee, is that I've been viewing now, if the organization does not take positions on legislation as a group where they have voted to take that position and forward that effort, then they really don't have business before the legislature. It may be individuals on the chalkboard project. It may be individuals on the health care proposals. You may be working on a work group to try to resolve those, but that group as a collective basis, I don't believe at this point in time, move forward those agendas because they're not organized as such. Now, if some of those individuals that are serving on those work groups are, as I've laid out before you, the current Oregon law, registered lobbyists based on what our guidelines are, so they have to register with the Government Standards and Practices Commission, the fact that you've had those conversations with those individuals in that sort of development of those policies, I don't believe necessarily means that if the chalkboard project is collectively, and I don't know who picks up the dinner there, I don't know who's funding those projects. You can answer those questions better than I. That's when it becomes a question. And I think, again, the members have to decide for themselves. If tonight the tab is being picked up by a registered lobbyist, chances are you should be paying for your own. If it's picked up by the group somehow without funding, and they don't have interest, then I think you probably could participate. I mean, that's about as clear as mud. But again, it all comes back to the intent of these rules, and the intent of these rules, as I believe they to be, was more transparency, more openness, and guidelines that would really put the House of Representatives beyond the public perception that some of the members can potentially be influenced by someone buying them a dinner or providing them a gift.
So before we move on to the question of who has business before the legislature, are both of you satisfied with where we've come to with the making of remarks and the serving on a panel, and the idea of clarifying that for our colleagues along with the other work we've done with a summary letter at the conclusion of our work. All right, so moving on to who has business before the legislature. Ramona has provided us with a handout regarding current Oregon law. Did you want to give some introductory remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I've done is provided you what current Oregon law is, on at what level does an individual, an organization, be viewed as a lobbyist. And if you look at that, it doesn't take much time nor much money before you hit that level. And at, according to the statutes, you then must register with the Government Standards and Practices Commission. And this really, it covers both volunteer lobbyists for the nonprofits and also for those who are getting paid. The other information that I have, Madam Chair, although I didn't copy it because it's 31 pages long, is on the NCSL website, National Conference of State Legislatures website, there is a survey that has been done that defines what is lobbying and who is a lobbyist. And in most cases, Oregon fits within a lot of those guidelines and how that's been defined in other states. And I find Oregon even more conservative than most states in what they define as a lobbyist. And I know that this provides rather a clear line, which may be too broad for this committee, but it is a clear line in that it's already in statute, and it basically suggests that if a person who spends more than 24 hours during a calendar quarter lobbying, or who spends over $100 during a calendar quarter in that effort, is a lobbyist. And I would suggest that, you know, if a citizen advocate, a constituent, someone that wants to come up and testify in front of the committee, that for them to have access, as I believe is necessary, and I'm now weighing in a little bit probably over the line of being parliamentarian and chief clerk here, but, you know, part of this is a democracy to have access to this process and being able to come and visit with their legislators and being able to advocate for or against legislation. But I would suggest that maybe we would want to look at these lines and see if maybe this might help provide some guidance that really would define who has business before the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Well, I just note that the definition of lobbying in ORS 171.725 sub 8 is very, very inclusive, and I'd just like to read it, since we don't have a copy of it in front of us. Lobbying means influencing or attempting to influence legislative action through oral or written communication with legislative officials, solicitation of others to influence or attempt to influence legislative action, or attempting to obtain the goodwill of legislative officials. That's the definition of lobbying. I would think that you combine that with the statute that you've reproduced, 0.735, with sub 4. I think, strictly speaking, anybody who spends more than 24 hours in a calendar quarter writing letters to legislators, asking legislators to take certain positions on bills, is a lobbyist, mm-hmm. By definition. Well, I suspect that some of my constituents would find that kind of an amazing interpretation. I receive a number of letters from some from some constituents that would suggest to me that they probably spend more than 24 hours during a calendar quarter writing them. But the definition, they certainly fit the definition of lobbying because they engage in written communication with legislative officials. So this is a fairly inclusive kind of thing. It's certainly, the exceptions, of course, are are those who who are public officials, those who are in the news media, and those whose lobbying consists solely of formal appearances to give testimony. And of course, then a certain executive branch and agents and judges. So this is a pretty inclusive list. So we have to be careful to using the word lobbyist in any of our guidelines, because there are a lot of lobbyists out there under these statutory definitions who we don't normally think of as lobbyists, as we think about the way in which we conduct our business. I think that more generally we would think of the lobbyists as those under the definition sub 9 of that statute I was referring to, sub A, any person who agrees to provide personal service for money or any other consideration for the purpose of lobbying. If you are the president of the League of Women Voters, I think, and you come to the legislature to lobby and you do more than just formal appearances, I think you're very clearly that you're a lobbyist within this definition, because it says lobbyist also means B, any person not otherwise subject to paragraph A who provides personal services as a representative of a corporation, association, organization, or other group for the purpose of lobbying. So there's a lot of lobbyists out there who probably don't think of themselves as lobbyists, but in fact are under our statute.
Kristen Richardson.
Madam Chair, I think that we could say that business before the legislature would be, would not include a group that does not take a position on legislature before the body or otherwise qualify as a lobbyist under the terms of ORS, and we plug in
171.725
A and B, and then registered lobbyists are deemed to have business before the legislature. We're just tying it into existing statute. We're not trying to develop something that's not already there.
Madam Chair, members, I did not copy 171.725 because as it was defined, then as you go into, as I read it into 171.735,
right,
then it gave you the exceptions. And I do believe that if you look at 171.740, which I have also copied,
right,
that if in fact you exceed these limits, you're required then to register with the Government Standards and Practices Commission.
Correct.
And so it would be interesting to maybe find out from them as to, sort of how they are sort of enforcing that piece or that provision. I appreciate the definitions that Representative Barnhart has brought forward. I do think, though, it is critical that you look at the exceptions under 171.735,
right,
in that I believe that those were added so that for the purposes of ensuring that the news media will be exempt, that, a legislative official acting in official capacity would be exempt. And you can go down through the list. And I also added 171.790 because in your decisions last at our last meeting, mm-hmm, it was determined that local government officials or anyone elected should fall outside of the gift guidelines. And under 171.790, it also states that an official officer or employee is not required to register with the government and that the rules that the commission adopted thereunder. So I viewed that as they are not being viewed as a lobbyist either, under the provisions of 171.725 through 171.785. So it kind of ties into decisions already made by this committee and, trying to provide that line and being clear about that line.
Yeah,
Representative Richardson.
So could we incorporate, under the terms of ORS and then do the include 171.725.8, 9 A and B, 735, and 790, and thereby include a definition of what would be a lobbyist and then include the exclusions that would carve out of that those that might otherwise qualify but really are not doing it enough to justify it. And then would that solve the problem?
I think it would solve the problem, except that I can still imagine that it's not within the intent of the law, the intent of the guidelines, that some individuals that might fall outside of the exception here, for example, someone that comes to your office to talk to you about an issue brings you a $25 book. I don't know that the spirit of the guidelines were to exempt these people for the purposes of providing gifts. I think that, and maybe they were. I just think that this would open up many people to that question of, okay, I can receive gifts and meals and all of these things from anybody that isn't a registered lobbyist.
Yeah, that is definitely a problem. I don't know that I was referring to all these statutes for the purpose of saying that only lobbyists have business before the legislature. It was to illustrate the statute writer's view of when they needed to call somebody a lobbyist. There are really two levels of this, too. The one is that they define lobbying and lobbyist in ORS 171.725, and then the statute that was reproduced, 0.735, is to give an indication of those who are lobbyists who do not have to register with the commission. And then it goes on to talk about the commission. It isn't that these people aren't lobbyists, it's that they are lobbyyists, but they don't have to register.
You're really saying then that 735 exceptions wouldn't apply to what we're trying to accomplish here.
That's right. And I'm not sure that we even necessarily want to apply the same framework, because this statute is very, very inclusive. And I think the question, the value of looking at these is that this is a probably rough and ready definition of what the legislature, when this statute was adopted originally, sometime between 1973 and 2001, what the legislature thought was attempting to influence it. And therefore, I mean, one of the ways of thinking about business before the legislature is subject matter. Is there something that we're doing that a person out there is interested in? Does that give them business before the legislature by definition? Or do they have business before the legislature only if they are lobbying? Or if the purpose of these meetings is to do some kind of lobbying? If you think about it in terms of subject matter, maybe everybody has business before the legislature, so that's not particularly helpful. Maybe if you think of it in terms of the verb, influencing or attempting to influence, then we're starting to narrow the constellation of the world down to something that is more manageable.
What if it was something very simple, that a person or organization with business before the legislature is one that in the course of a legislative session will attempt to influence the actions of the legislature by any means, for any reason? Well, which would exempt, I mean, that would pull out places like NCSL,
the Rotary Club,
and the Rotary Club, because they're not trying to influence the work of the legislature, but it would influence anyone that was coming in to lobby or persuade on a particular bill. It would distinguish out one of the questions at the beginning of the session when Representative Greenlick was in the hospital: which flowers was he allowed to keep? That would weed out the flowers that came from his neighbors versus the constituent who had a bill that he introduced on their
unless on he their gave them away within 30 days.
Right.
The flower exception.
Madam Chair, I certainly see the the attempt to have brevity and clarity. Sometimes it's easier to have brevity than it is have clarity. The one point that Representative Barnhart brings out is that if they're tied into statutes that are in place, they've been vetted,
right.
They've dealt with unintended consequences that we in this committee may have a hard time spotting, but they're more inclusive and more specific because they're trying to deal with things that they may have seen in other states at the time that the LC was doing the drafting or that came out of the committee discussion and change of amendment. And I just think that it's a little risky for us as a committee to try and come up with wording that is going to do it without having unintended consequences. That could be a problem.
Well, there are easy cases, aren't there? An organization which in its own bylaws says we're non-political and if we deal with political subjects, it's in a balanced way, is obviously not, doesn't have business before the legislature, by definition. And I'm thinking of the Rotary Club. It is a clear example of that. When the Rotary Club follows its own bylaws, it doesn't have business before the legislature, clearly by definition. It may provide a public forum for discussion of legislative issues, but if it follows its own rules, then it would present a balanced forum. That would be one extreme of organized groups. The other extreme, of course, are groups that are organized specifically for the purpose of influencing legislation. And that's all they do. Somewhere in between is where the line is, and I don't know where it is.
The gray area is like we have a group of churches that come and
right.
are lobbying us
mm-hmm.
because they want more money for programs
social
that may
program.
Support
right.
things that they're involved
or whatever,
in.
Right.
And they certainly have an interest in the outcome, and they're trying to influence the things that we're doing. But if you read their charter, it wouldn't talk in terms of being involved in influencing legislation.
Right.
But do they come under the banner of their church, or do they come under the banner of an organization that they have formed that might be faith-based, but it's not First Baptist Church, it's the Coalition Against the Hungry, or Against Hunger, not Against the Hungry.
Well, I think you get both.
Yeah.
Because we've had some actually, they
right.
come and there are dioceses or whatever that have paid
yeah.
lobbyists.
Wow.
Yeah, the Archdiocese yeah. of Portland has a paid lobbyist, and they routinely lobby. Yeah.
Can you do that?
Sure.
And still have your church taxes?
Well, I don't know that they work directly for the Archbishop. They may work for a different organization, but it's under the thumb
clear
of the Archbishop.
What they're doing.
Right.
They're probably not
right.
hired by the church. They're hired by some other organization
right.
that supports the church.
And their
right. And perhaps the funding of that organization isn't tax exempt.
Right.
Ramona.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I can provide much wisdom here or give you any sense of this given my past experiences. In reviewing again the table that I got from the National Conference of State Legislatures, knowing that, you know, we are probably maybe one of the latter states to have started to deal with gift guidelines and provide for some guidance to our members, what I have been told and what I've read is that there is a fine balance between ensuring that your constituencies can come feeling freely to participate in this democracy, to participate in sharing their views, and to letting the committees and the members know that, in fact, they care about a particular issue or sets of issues, depending on the subject matter, and what it means to trying to maybe on behalf of an organization, on behalf of a group, attempting to influence a legislator. And so I don't know what the easy answer is. I would hope that should a constituent of yours come to your office and as a gesture of maybe just a thank you or whatever, providing you with something that would be deemed a gift, particularly a book or something that maybe would talk about the subject matter that is before them or something that maybe has influenced them. And I've had this question not only from you, Madam Chair, but from several members in that somebody will have come in and as a gesture, not knowing the gift guideline rules, offer you something. And as a courtesy, instead of you saying, no, I can't take that, you accept it and then re-gift it. That's a situation that each member has to make for themselves. But I also am very sensitive to the fact that I think we need to make sure that we don't send a message also that because it is so ratcheted down that it becomes like that the message we're sending is that you don't really get to come and talk about your issues. I would suggest that even though if you look at these guidelines and we talk about the 24 hours and we talk about the $100, you know, at some point in time that is a law that's on the books, that those who are clearly in it for doing advocacy work, they understand these rules, they are registering. You know, there may be that constituent that has spent those 24 hours laboring over that testimony that they're going to give to the revenue committee to make sure that it's very, very clear and focused, probably doesn't understand that rule and probably doesn't register. But again, I think that you are putting in a very difficult position of trying to decide who has business before the legislature. I also would suggest, however, that those constituents that are coming to participate in this process probably are not going to ask to take you to lunch, are probably not going to try to give you a gift, are probably not going to try to do something by providing you a ticket and or a fee on a golf course. And so I think you probably are safe if you decide that you can use some of the statutes that are already in place, because that is a clear line and it provides some direction that I think members clearly want when they try to adhere to the rules. And what gets them in trouble is when you leave it very gray.
Madam Clerk, thank you very much. I'm certainly persuaded to go back to the recommendation that Representative Richardson made following Representative Barnhart's remarks that we adopt what we currently have with the exceptions, that perhaps we attach that to in a format that's readable to the letter that we send to our colleagues outlining the work of the committee, that this becomes the definition of business before the legislature.
Madam Chair, what I will be doing if it meets with the committee's approval is that I will probably be transcribing this committee meeting so that I can kind of, I've been taking notes, but try to clearly find out where it was that you all were coming from and maybe about 15 minutes ago. But again,
you're ahead of us if you I managed to do that.
But I would like to then maybe sit down with you each individually, so that we can go through that, fine-tune that language, make sure that that does meet with your approval, all three of your approvals, and then we will forward it as the recommendation from this committee. One final note, Madam Chair, is that I do believe that we may want to have a meeting prior to the end of session, particularly to provide maybe a potential couple rule changes, because I think it is vague clearly now with what we've said in the rules and what we've decided the guidelines really are. And also at that point in time, maybe take under consideration if there's any unintended consequences as we move into the interim, particularly as it pertains to town halls and other activities that might happen during a campaign season.
Thank you. I think that sounds like a very good plan. And I'd like to suggest, given that everyone is very busy, that perhaps you and I work initially on doing some of that fine-tuning, put the information in the format of a letter so that there's a point to start that conversation with my two colleagues here so we can be as efficient as possible, and certainly plan to schedule that meeting later, and we can reconvene during the session should there be issues that pop up in the meantime. But thank you very much for working on ironing these things out. It's been, I think, a very efficient experience, and I appreciate both of your logic and ability to think quickly and clearly and logically on issues of common sense and ethics and, in the end, self-policing, which I think that we can trust each other and our colleagues to exercise good judgment in carrying out the spirit of these rules.
Chair, do you want to talk about open to the public, or do we want to do that?
Open to the public. Thank you for remembering. Open to the public. There had been a question initially about what open to the public was. I've not heard as many questions about this as time has gone on. I believe that we addressed this incidentally when we were talking about the issue of incidental entertainment, and I wanted to loop back around to make sure that we got to it. And open to the public was an event that any member of the public could attend either by purchasing a ticket or walking in, that they would not be turned away. Is that a common understanding of open to the public? Ramona?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, the questions that came before the clerk as these rules were first adopted was that there was a request for a table to have been purchased for a particular event. And since the event was open to the public, the guidance I received was that the tickets then could have been purchased and gifted to the members. I was under the impression that if the gift was free to the public, then it could be free to the members. But I think where it comes back to is, and I don't know enough events to be selective in the events I'm choosing, I would suggest now that we've just sort of sifted through who has business before the legislature, that I would suggest, I'm not sure that the Portland City Club as a group has business before the legislature. And so they would fall outside of that guide, out of that definition. However, there was request made by the City Club to provide complimentary tickets to the Portland delegation to attend the Portland City Club meeting, where that somebody else would have had to pay for that meal. And I suggested that each member should pay for their own meal. I was told then later on that maybe that wasn't the intent of that rule. I think it becomes somewhat complicated and somewhat unclear that obviously a Blazer game is very open to the public. And therefore, you know, if you use that standard, although the entire, it falls outside of the intent of the meeting would be for entertainment, clearly, it's a ticket and or a fee, that covers the Blazer games or, you know, green fees. However, I'm not sure what that does when it's like some of the dinners that maybe the Democrats typically attend or the Republicans typically attend, where that it could be a gifted, where a lobbyist buys a table and asks you to come with them and sit at that table. And I think where you are going to fall into problems with this is, i.e., let's look at some campaign celebrations. I.e., before the session started, there was the governor's ball, I believe, and lobbyists had bought some of those tables. And therefore, the members did not have to pay for their tickets. They were gifted those tickets, where other people did have to pay. And so, if we get back into the election cycle, could a member have accepted that complimentary ticket? I don't know. That was something that, again, I think we need to think about as we move into the interim, because I think that's when those dinners, those meetings typically happen.
Was that a fundraiser?
Yes.
Was it a political fundraiser? Was he
yes.
trying to raise money for a political action committee?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
I mean, that raises a whole different level of complication. I know that we dealt with the idea that earlier that political parties, by definition, don't have business before the legislature, and that took care of that issue. But this is another issue. This is a different issue.
And, Madam Chair, that's why I believe that before we walk into the interim, we really need to try to put on our thinking caps of those various situations that happen, you know better than I, where you have participated, in order to make sure that there's clear direction to the members, unless we, you know, do something different with the rules.
And it may be, too, as we move towards the interim where it's campaign season, the question is this an event that you're attending as a legislator, is this an event that you're attending as part of your campaign? Has someone just made a contribution to your campaign by purchasing the ticket to that dinner for you? So is that something that you should be reporting on your CNE?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think that we may be expanding this open to the public beyond where it needs to be. we have a number of rules that we already have in place about tickets, about meals, and so forth. My understanding was that by open the public, we were trying to make sure that members didn't have to pay for something that the public didn't have to pay for. Supposing there was a concert at the mall, and normally the tickets for a concert by this group would be $35, but they're doing it in the mall, and the public is coming and going, well, would a member have to pay? You know, no, not at all, because it's open to the public. What I wrote was, members are not required to pay for an item or event for which the public is not charged. In other words, if it's open to the public and doesn't cost, then it shouldn't cost the member. But on the other hand, if the public is paying a ticket, now the other rules that we have come into play as far as whether or not you're going to be able to get a ticket from someone else. If you're getting it from your Aunt Matilda, it's not a problem. She has no business before the legislature. If it's from a lobbyist, no way, because that violates the gift rule. And we already have these other rules in place. So I would think that would be wise to restrict this open to the public issue to not requiring members to do more than what a public public could be doing.
It's interesting because the interface with campaign finance is a touchy one, because the way for the lobbyists to deal with that issue that we were just describing, that the purchase of a table at the event would be to contribute money to the campaign, and then have you take money out of your campaign to spend on your own ticket to the other campaign event. I think that would be legal to do. I don't believe it would violate these rules.
That's a difference.
It would be recorded as a campaign contribution on the one hand and a campaign expenditure on the other. So it would go into the Secretary of State's records of the political action committee that you control as a candidate. And it would come under a whole different set of rules that govern that area of things. I don't know the answer to this one, because this, of course, is precisely one of the areas that the legislature was criticized on when we adopted this rule, or the House adopted this rule in the first place, is that it doesn't deal with the key issue, which is campaign finance reform.
No,
I don't have a response to that except to say, yeah, you're right, it doesn't deal with campaign finance reform.
Well, I think for the purposes of today, I think that your definition is a very good one, and I think that it for carrying us through the rest of the session, and I do think that this is, whether it's this issue itself or that larger issue of all of these events that we know that we all have to attend during the interim as part of campaigns, and how that interfaces with the gift rule, goes precisely to the need to reconvene towards the end of the session, looking forward to that, and perhaps providing some anticipatory guidance to our colleagues and ourselves.
And to ourselves, yes.
But for tonight, Representative Barnhart, are you comfortable with the definition that Representative Barnhart has
offered? I'm happy for today, with the understanding that we're going to revisit this before the end of the session. Right now we're under a rule that says we don't accept campaign contributions.
Right. But
once the session is over, that rule lapses, for this purpose anyway, and then all of a sudden these wrinkles...
They do, but we have a different set of rules applying to that.
Well, we may or may not. I don't know yet. We haven't got there yet.
Well, no, I mean, we presently have rules.
Yes, that's correct.
So,
yeah.
May I mend it a little bit? I already thought of an unintended consequence, and that is that what if there was, you know, something in the park, and it was $5, and everybody could come in for $5, and yet they may normally, if it wasn't a freebie, they would charge a lot of money. You know, Sarah Evans was singing or something like that. So what I rewrote was, members are not required to pay for an item or event to any extent greater than applies to the general public.
That makes sense.
Great.
Wonderful. Is there any further business before the committee this evening? Thank you both very much, and thank you, Rick, committee staff, and thank you, Ramona, for participating in this journey with us. And with that, I close our committee meeting.